the fact that music is so important for our constitution, at least this is our understanding, that music is almost how we move in the world, you know, that our own bodies are played through by musical forms, that the way we relate to our own way of being in the world is sort of mediated by music. You know, this is, I think Adam said earlier, powerful stuff, but it's not always very fitting to us. In other words, we hear a lot of music in our lives. We don't always choose what we hear. We don't choose our analyst's musicality. You know, we go and see somebody. We don't first check out what kind of musicality does our analyst have, right? We are bombarded by music. Music can impose upon us. It can make us feel within ourselves things in a way that doesn't feel right to us. So there's a lot of complexity here as we think about this matter of music being so central to us, where there's a way in which we have to find the music that works for us, but we don't create the music. It belongs to the realm of collective cultural life. So there's quite a lot of struggle, I think, over music. And in the analytic setting, there's a lot of struggle, because for many patients, a lot of the work rests on whether there can be any shared sensory experience or not.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my three guests today are Drs. Peter Goldberg, Michael Levin, and Adam Blum. And our conversation revolves around the book the three of them wrote together, A Story Unto Itself. The title of the book is Here I'm Alive, The Spirit of Music in Psychoanalysis. I'm going to let them introduce themselves so that you can get a sense of their voice with their name and who they are. And I hesitate to try to summarize, certainly not the book, but even our conversation, because it's so broad and so rich. Suffice it to say that some of the topics we touch on from the book are things that they've written about, which is rhythmizing consciousness, enhancing versus atavistic music, and dissociation and the necessity for remusicalization of the analytic space. That should give you a taste of the wide-ranging and deeply thoughtful comments that they have to make. I'm going to turn it over to the three of them and I so that we can jump right into this and they will introduce themselves. I hope you find this as fascinating as I did. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you here. Those of us who have spent a good deal of time Behind the Couch, have a feel for the musicality of the psychoanalytic experience. We all know that the most informed we could be about the patient and ours and the process at any moment is to appreciate the rhythms as opposed to the notes. And I've had the pleasure of speaking with colleagues whose love language, if you will, is the musical experience. And they've spoken about the interface that they feel, one with jazz, one with classical music, with opera. But the work that you three have written is of a different sort. Again, it is called Here I'm Alive, The Spirit of Music in Psychoanalysis. And I'm not going to try to summarize it. I don't think it lends itself to summary. It's so rich and broad. But what I'm going to do before I ask each of you to introduce yourself is I'm going to read just an opening couple of sentences, paragraphs from the preface to orient our listener to what they're about to enter into. It's like the prelude to a piece. You write, "Before we can become fully functioning, emotional, rational, linguistic, cultural, social, or political animals, human beings first become musical animals. The process of human musicalization begins in utero and undergirds many aspects of human psychosomatic social life to a degree that has been largely underappreciated in the modern era. This hypothesis has significant foundational implications for the theory and practice of psychoanalysis, and perhaps for other disciplines in the humanities and human sciences." Quote one. Quote two. "Dissociation, in turn, demands a remusicalizing of the psychoanalytic situation, beginning with the analyst." Quote three. "Immersion in music affects changes in our subjective state, not because of its evocation of associations and memories, but because of its power to awaken the psyche soma and configure the somatic language of the body, which revives the body's role in the life of the mind." Now, I trust that those listening will have a sense of the kind of journey we're about to go on. Peter, why don't you start? I'm letting you all introduce yourselves so the listener can link your voice with your name. And in addition to your analytic and musical background, share a bit about this labor of love that you three were involved with for the past 5 years. It is an enormous undertaking. And if you can give us a hint of what it meant for you to do, what you got out of it, and also what you hope the reader will leave after reading it. Peter?
Yes, hello. Well, I began being interested in this before I knew I was interested in it, going back many decades, when, as a beginning psychoanalyst, I was interested in ideology and social theory, and then became interested in dissociation as a phenomenon, and in non-representational states, which led to, you know, various musings about the body and altered states of consciousness, etc. And all of this led somehow to thinking and writing about music just about 8 or 10 years ago. I had the luck of running into these two young fellows, Adam and Mike, when I presented a paper on music in San Francisco, maybe 8 years ago. And we began then to meet and talk a little bit about it. And it turned into the writing of this book. I mean, literally, we wrote it around a kitchen table meeting once a month. And, you know, as I was preparing and looking at the book for today, looking over it, I was struck by how the book feels to me both familiar and surprising, in the sense that everything in it I had a hand in. We wrote it together, but of course we generated parts of it separately. So we would bring the material to the kitchen table and read it aloud, edit it, re-edit it. And so reading the book again, or looking at the book, actually has the feeling of what it was like to make the book. It was a little bit like being in a band. So I think that, you know, there's so much that evolved in the writing of the book. It wasn't plotted out exactly in terms of its content, but we did have a sort of a structure. And, of course, the book is about, it's not a psychoanalytic book about music. It's a sort of musical book about psychoanalysis in the sense of how we are operating at a kind of a musical level when we practice, but also how music binds us to the collective domains, cultural domains of human perception and sensation. So it really is quite a wide-ranging way of thinking about music. At the same time, there really are quite strong clinical implications, I feel. Certainly in my work over the last few years, I felt that when I opened the door to the waiting room, I'm in some kind of implicit or even sometimes explicit mode of setting in motion something at this level of an engagement with a patient. So this is both a clinical book, and even though we don't use clinical cases, and a book about broader sociological issues.
Peter, just tell us something about your analytic background, history, credentials.
Well, I'm a psychoanalyst in San Francisco. I came here in my late 20s and to do a PhD and then did analytic training. So I've been working in the community here for all these 35, 40 years and am at San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and at the other analytic institute, the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California.
And to the many people who are listening and are trying to place exactly where your accent is from, can you help them out?
I'm South African, and I came here in my late 20s, so I thought I'd lost my accent by now, but, you know.
Not quite. No, not quite. Mike?
Thanks a lot for having us, Harvey. I guess I'll start quickly with my background. I'm a psychoanalyst in San Francisco. I trained at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, where I was a student of Peter's. And now I'm now on the faculty and a training analyst at the SFCP. In terms of the origins of my interest in this project, I was always interested in the way that I felt at its best, a treatment took on a flow, a rhythm, a sense of being in sync, and something that felt very much like music or sports at their most lively and most fluent. And during my analytic training, I developed a side interest in philosophy, especially existential phenomenology. And that gave me a way to start thinking about some of these aspects of psychoanalytic experience, psychoanalytic treatment, both as a clinician and as a patient, that I hadn't found as much in the psychoanalytic discourse itself. And around that time, I became very interested in work that Peter had been doing for years on, as he said, perception, dissociation, and non-representational states, the sub-symbolic domain of psychical life. And I discussed a paper that Peter presented at the SFCP, I think 2011, a few years before the paper he mentioned on music. And that really sort of got the ball rolling for me in this direction. And then, as Peter said, we all took part in this later presentation of Peter's presentation on music about 7 years ago that Adam discussed. I moderated that program. And from there, there was a very organic process of the three of us talking excitedly about these ideas in a way that actually felt very musical and fluid. And it just made sense that this thing might have the potential to become a book. And the process took off, the process that Peter described, sitting around a kitchen table and writing it together. and emailing a lot between those meetings.
Just want to mention one of the things, one of the many things I enjoyed about the book is it refers to your comment about when sitting with a patient and feeling a synchronicity. What would be the right word?
Synchronization. Yeah.
Synchronization. But what you don't omit in yours is, of course, that isn't the full extent of the analytic experience. There is also breaks in that synchrony, and there's a dissonance. And it is the working with the back and forth between in-tune and out-of-tuneness that yields often great meanings, great pieces of history in the person's life, and potentially great progress. And you all include that in the musicality that you referred to.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Adam?
Yes. Well, thank you for having us, Harvey, and for your introduction. I'm actually neither a psychoanalyst nor a musician by formal training, although I've spent much of my life passionately engaged with one or the other of those disciplines, and indeed with both of them at the same time. And that's the best way I can sort of speak to what I feel one has to do with the other is first and foremost just how much they both light me up. And I think that's also the spirit in which we approached this project, was just to sort of from a place of kind of groundedness in both of those modalities, if you will, to see what happens if we create conditions in which we can speak to each other and track something over time, perhaps not unlike our work as therapists. So to your question about what kind of reader might enjoy the book, I mean, it's in some sense this conversation that emerged from the experiment of sitting with each other and thinking about music and psychoanalysis, which of course is thinking, you know, musically about psychoanalysis and thinking psychoanalytically about music, but also something else that's sort of greater than the sum of its parts. And it's been an absolutely transformative experience for me getting to be in a band with these guys. So
now the listener can't see you as I can, but there's a guitar hanging up on your wall. So I'm assuming, in addition to being interested in the therapy world, you're a musician. Yes?
I know my way around a couple of instruments.
That's a nice way to put it.
But primarily, I think of myself actually as a music listener, if one's ear could be considered one's instrument. And I will say that, you know, that inevitably leads to lots of curation of playlists and mixes. And that's something I do for myself and for people with whom I share music. And there's something about the writing of this book that really feels just exactly like making a mix, you know, just that much more than, you know, having an idea that we sat down to sort of explicate. It was this excited, you know, sampling and collecting pieces from the world and seeing if we could sequence them and stitch them together in ways that would become its own kind of musical experience.
Let me stay with you, Adam, and ask your comments on what I'm about to read. The book writes, I don't know which one of you wrote it, and it may not even exist in that form, so I'll just read it. The relation of body to rhythm is one of mimesis, of identification, vanishing the distance between subject and object, erasing the categories altogether. A human being must be rhythmized. It is through rhythms that one becomes human, and it is in these rhythms that embodiment takes place. You then reference the phrase, which I immediately caught my eye, it's rhythmizing consciousness. And then you go on to say, when consciousness fails to become rhythmized, it can get no help from shared beats and becomes a slave of quantity without quality. When things are dysfunctional in the rhythm section, there is only noise, nausea, the disintegration products of a quantified, reified world. It's all yours, Adam.
Yeah, so this comes from the second chapter of the book, which is mostly about rhythm. And this idea of rhythmizing consciousness comes from a slender volume titled Rhythms. The author is a the French psychoanalyst Nicolas Abraham, who's born in Hungary. The book is not about psychoanalysis. It's actually not about music either. It's about poetry. You might think, as I do, of rhythm as sort of the musical dimension of poetry. But Abraham's idea is, if we're going to talk about rhythm, we're not talking about something external that is perceived. We're talking about something that happens to perception itself, that perception becomes rhythmized. And his way of illustrating this point is to invite the reader to imagine being on a train and hearing the repetition of the sound of the train against the tracks, you know, ch-tung, ch-tung, ch-tung. And then to imagine doing something that we've all probably done, which is to play with it a little bit. So to actually pretend that the next beat is not simply happening to us, but that we are making it happen, whether that's by tapping one's foot or just simply imagining that one is in some sense conducting this sound. And Abraham thinks that what happens there is we become rhythmized. And what he describes is a shift in consciousness, that he says it takes on a quality of what he calls a dreamlike unreality. Now, if the listener is feeling there's something familiar about being asked to imagine that one is on a train, they may be thinking of course, Freud's recommendation, not only to readers and analysts, but to patients, to his prescription for free associating, to imagine that one is on a train, looking out the window and simply reporting to someone else in the carriage what one sees. So the sort of opening gambit of this chapter was, what if that's not a coincidence? What if this reference to at least a potentially rhythmic experience when describing the fundamental rule of psychoanalysis is meaningful? And indeed, the process by which free association happens has its own potentially rhythmic quality in that it happens in a repetitive way for a fixed period of time at a certain time on certain days of the week repeatedly. And what we found ourselves wondering is, does this repetition become rhythm in a way that creates the conditions in which a dreamlike unreality, or perhaps a dreamlike reality, or any work of psychoanalysis would necessarily require in order to proceed? In other words, the binding that allows the analytic work of unbinding to happen. And once one is in a rhythm, Abraham says, when there are, you referred to this earlier, Harvey, when there are disruptions, interruptions, these are experienced not as the end of the rhythm, but they become woven into the rhythm as accents or syncopations. So this is very powerful. To withstand the inevitable variations of analytic work, the necessary variations. This is not very far from what Freud meant by working through, or perhaps what Winnicott meant by going on being.
Thank you for that. Peter, the psychical domain of musicality is not a primitive or atavistic area, or an enclave of the sublimated or the artistic, neither something left behind nor a paradise, let alone unlost narcissism. It is right here, right now, at the intersection of the lived body with the world, musicalized through the companionship of shared perception. The rhythm of the frame, like all music, only exists as music insofar as it is experienced through this mutual sensoriality as music.
Well, I'm still a bit hungover from what Adam was saying, and when he referred to the train rhythm.
9:34 a.m.
And I think, Adam, just do it again. Can you do it again, Adam? The train?
Da-dum. Right. That you know, one moment it's just this repetitive sound. And I know you can remember.
Do it. I think.
Make the sound. He's the musician. Yeah.
Well, you're the one who really knows what it sounds like. You should do it.
I do. That's right. I wanted to correct you.
Okay. See, I didn't fall into that trap.
The way it is ta-doom, 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 ta-doom. Yeah. And that is, I think, literally, when I mentioned opening the door to the waiting room earlier, that literally the way the door opens, the way the analyst moves towards the door, moves towards the chair, induces a certain kind of state. I mean, there's a regularity to all of this that is absolutely necessary. The patient has to be able to count on a very familiar ritual of entering the room. But there is a subtle change at in any given session in that rhythm. And if it becomes too repetitive, if it becomes simply the repetition that never changes, then it becomes a kind of a dead frame. It becomes an institution. It seals itself off. So there's a great deal that goes on, we think, in the sort of subtle shifts in the rhythm of what goes on between patient and analyst. And whether we're aware of it or not, we are enlivening each other through small changes, subtle changes in the tone, in the rhythm of our speech, in how often we speak up, how we stay quiet, how we breathe, etc. This is the level, I think, that's being described, Harvey, when you mention that paragraph. There is a mutual induction at the level of sensory experience that seems like a basic dimension of what goes on in the analysis. And for some patients, it's where the action is, because some patients who are isolated in the sense of not being able to join in the sort of ordinary rhythms of interaction with others actually require from us greater attention to this level of what goes on in analysis.
Mike, the book writes, "The blues are a kind of companion soundtrack for loss and tribulation, an accompaniment or technology for dwelling in sorrow in a full way. Certain sensations call for this kind of accompaniment, where the analyst must find and join the repeated phrases of hopelessness in the patient's feeling state and preclude one's own sense of futurity for the sake of unison at the crossroads of no past and no future."
So here we're talking about the musical idiom of the blues as being a special form of being that allows for what we call remembering, by which we mean a process of being brought back in to what we call the we, the shared fabric of human experience. The kind of pain that the blues addresses and the kind of historical experience that it emerged from is one of what we call dismemberment or unmemberment, where trauma has been so ferocious, so unthinkable, that it dissolves the fundamental social bonds that we need to feel fully human. And people who are unmembered, dismembered, feel fundamentally lost in the world, isolated. So the blues is a form of music, and we believe a form of potentially of psychoanalytic experience that addresses this level of existence, finds a rhythm, finds a melody, finds a tempo and finds a mood, a whole mode of experience, a disposition that allows for remembering, that is bringing a human being back into membership in the collective weave of human experience that includes the isolation, the pain, the trauma that they have experienced that has led to unmemberment or dismemberment in the first place.
And as you say, it allows for a sense of a future and with it the possibility of hope. Yes.
Yeah.
This is the part of our conversation where, as I've said, I'm going to ask each of us to read a paragraph that we haven't been told about before. And the part that I want to start us off, I mean, as the listener can tell, this is a remarkable work. And to select one piece to focus on is impossible and not even desirable. That said, one of the pieces that just my eyes lit up when I read it, because A, I'd never thought of it before, I've never read about it before, and it just sparkled. And it's about your comments about the importance of Freud's joke book. It just turned everything I thought about on its head in such a delightful way. And let me read this brief comment on it. You write, We are enlivened by the other's laughter and pleasure when we share a joke. Yet at the same time, we learn to accept that we don't know the full extent of how and why someone finds our joke funny and are moved by the enigmatic ways in which they do. What does it mean that psychoanalysis has placed greater value on the interpretation of dreams than on determining jokes' relation to the unconscious? Both of Freud's early works try to demonstrate and analyze the presence of the unconscious in everyday experiences. But the joke, unlike the dream, is shared, intimate, and explicitly playful and pleasurable. What if Freud's books on those subjects had traded places in terms of their influence on Freud's thought and the thought of his followers? What if psychoanalysis became as good at getting jokes as it is at getting dreams? If we told and got our jokes like we tell and get our dreams, where would we be now? Would laughter replace tears as a signal of clinical breakthrough? Anybody, you're all smiling. But that was my reaction. Anybody want to comment on that?
Go on, Adam.
You know, this bubbled up kind of pretty early on in the process together, probably because we were making each other laugh. And I think in terms of thinking about this as a musical experience, you know, there's something just self-evident when a joke works or when a joke kills that involves bodies together in a shared way that goes to the heart of what we are trying to understand about music. And the capacity to be moved by a joke or tickled by a joke necessarily implicates both members in such a vital, nuanced way that I think all of us care a lot about in our clinical work, but that somehow got the short shrift in our theory, perhaps because the jokes in the joke book have not aged very well. So it's not a particularly rewarding reading experience compared to the interpretation of dreams. But yeah, what do you guys think?
Just to comment on that, I think the other point that you make that I didn't read was about the central importance of the joke requiring another to have that encounter. But it also strikes me that an important difference between the two and may have clinical implications is that everybody's dream is idiosyncratic. It reveals a piece of who they are in that moment of time in their transference context. Whereas jokes are sort of universal. You can tell a joke to 10 people and 10 people will laugh. Maybe not for identical reasons, but essentially they will get the joke. So in that sense, the dream, I don't think they're interchangeable in terms of it being a window into one's unconscious, but certainly privileging the power of joke, and certainly I think we all would share the sense that a hearty laugh in the office with both people for many people is a vital piece of progress. For others, they sort of come in with that, but the jokes then aren't very funny. It's when they're collectively created mm-hmm. that they become the meaningful progress that you're talking about. Anybody else have thoughts on this? I think it's a fabulous point.
Well, I'll just say that it just strikes me now as we're talking that, you know, part of the problem with the joke book, Freud's joke book, is it doesn't work to read jokes. You know, you've got
right.
So, I mean, if it had been like a podcast or something that he was doing, Freud, maybe it would have gotten more traction. The other thing is, I think the joke model is really interesting because it does involve live bodies and things going on at this level of shared sensation. I don't think it's so much that one has to sort of crack jokes in the office with the patient, but that the whole thing is closer to a joke setup than a dream setup. You know, I know we think of the analytic setting as this kind of, you know, and I agree, as a kind of a dream, dreamlike experience, but it's actually to some degree like a joke-like experience. You know, what is actually going to happen in the setting? And is something going to happen? Strikes me.
In the sense that we're all waiting for the punchline kind of thing?
Yeah, and also looking for how something can happen. You know, looking yeah. for the joke in a way, rather than trying to produce it too strenuously.
How it emerges spontaneously at its best, you know, the joke or the funny moment in analysis, and it has so much to do with shared perception, like Peter was talking about, and timing, being in sync, being in the flow. It has a lot of overlap with good musical experience, especially making music. And it's as everyone has said already, it's very much embodied. And there's a quote that I always think about when I think about humor and analysis too, that we all know from Adam Phillips, which is that this goes something like, if Freud taught us anything, it is that it's not more truthful to be serious. So a joke or a moment of laughter can be one of the most truthful moments in analysis or in life for them.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you have your paragraph?
Sure. I mean, book anywhere and pick one out.
That's just my feeling too.
I'm sort of surprised at every paragraph here. You know, how did this come about? So mine is on page 55. It's the beginning of Mind Waves, chapter 3. Resuming analytic work always involves a change of rhythm, a shift towards the temporality of the frame. Through the reliability of the frame's beat, we are given an opportunity to feel what Milan Kundera once called slowness, to sense what the philosopher Han calls the scent of time. To work psychoanalytically is to become practiced at this slowness, this adagio movement, to eddy the torrential stream of stimulation in a harbor of temporal restoration, of slow, steady beat, which also serves as a bulwark against what Han calls the violence of non-time. Heading into a session, the world's atmospheric frequencies lengthen towards the pulse of analytic time, embodied by the particular analyst companion, who, in days and weeks and years of practice, has become a living expression of the analytic frame, inducing the patient into analytic consciousness. To flip the light and invite the patient into what is still evocatively referred to as the consulting room, the spatial dimension of the frame is to induce a potentially jarring shift of gears, a slackening of tension, an elongating of time's amplitude that may provoke a fleeting yet palpable reticence. What happens to us when the rhythm changes? What tempo plays within the frame, intoxicating us with the scent of time? I like that.
Good pick, Peter. Yeah, sounds pretty good. And I know what you mean about the surprise of reading the book and hearing the book, recognizing it, but not knowing exactly where it came from. I was just going to say that Yeah, so this is the first paragraph in the chapter Mind Waves, which is a reference to a quote from Virginia Woolf, who says that style is all a matter of rhythm, that once you find this wave in the mind, that everything else follows. And the chapter is about hypnosis. So this is about the power of rhythmizing and rhythmized perception, that it becomes a fascinated consciousness and is extremely resilient to whatever would interrupt or break it. And so this has implications for the responsibility or the ethos of the analyst who is managing this whole operation, because this is strong stuff. And how the analyst conducts oneself becomes of paramount importance for that reason, because we're always giving off more than we realize, no matter how trained or well-intentioned we are. There's excess heat, surplus energy, just through the provision of the rhythm and what Winnicott called the holding environment that we're talking about. And that becomes exactly what interrupts and shakes things up and indeed seduces, to use LaPlanche's term, the rhythm into becoming an actually lived, shared groove that happens between people.
Mike, anything you want to add?
To tag on to what Adam is saying, that part of searching for, finding, and maintaining a good holding environment in treatment, we're saying it has to do with being a good conductor that is attending to the musical dimension of the frame, the rhythm between sessions over the course of the week, weeks of the month, months of the year, and within the session, attending to melody, rhythm, synchronization, or lack thereof.
Mike, you have your paragraph?
Yes, let's see here. So this is the first paragraph in chapter 8, which is the title of the chapter is This Is How We Do It. An ethos is not a force of nature, but a force of human nature, essentially a force of habit or a system of habits shared by every member of the culture, what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu referred to as habitus, a shared meaningful cultural system of physical comportment that is always already there before and enabling any emergence of an individual experience of having a self or even of having a body. Through habitus, the whole system of meaningfulness lights up before the individual takes his or her place in it. In a way that's difficult for members of our contemporary culture to grasp, Bourdieu believed that the child, before becoming a subject, exists in a shared social habitus, embodying the music of hexus, this is another term from Bourdieu, before finding or using words to speak or sing its subjectivity, the child's own subjectivity. And we have a quote from Bourdieu, which I'll skip over, back to us. So it is not simply, as documented through recent developments in infant observation and developmental research, that each mother-infant dyad, and subsequently each analyst-patient dyad, create unique forms of musical connection, communication, and embodied attunement, but also that they find meaningful forms made available in the cultural commons, as it were. The shared fabric of perception that underwrites what Winnicott describes as the transitional area, the area of the found created, the quote, found created, unquote, where usable cultural objects are discovered paradoxically as one's own invention. The frame of psychoanalytic work, in this sense, acts as a metonym for the larger habitus by which and through which we conduct ourselves, providing a forum and a form for finding, creating oneself, for free association, a literal figure of speech complete with its own hexus of physical posture and interpersonal configuration.
Do you want to, just before we ask for comments, Mike, can you share with us what led you to that paragraph?
I think it's a pretty good summary, or it points more directly at what we might call primordial music. Peter touched on this a few minutes ago when he talked about induction. But one of the basic points that we're making in the book is that in order to become fully human and to be able to engage in what psychoanalysis has to offer, the human being originally, hopefully, you know, optimally as an infant, is brought into the shared musicality of human existence, which we also call the weave. And we think that Bourdieu gets very close to this, although he doesn't speak as much as we do in terms of music, with his concept of habitus, which is really on the level of the body. It's a shared system of what he calls comportment, ways of behaving, actions, that gives rise to a psychological disposition and discloses a certain world, a certain shared domain of meaningful domain of existence. And a lot of the book is about how analysis can, as Peter said, induce the patient into this world if the patient comes into treatment unmembered, that is isolated from it, and how it underwrites just about everything we think that else that happens in psychoanalytic treatment.
Mm-hmm. Peter, Adam, any comments?
You know, in a way, I guess what in crude terms you can say that there's a sort of shift in amongst many of us, I guess, in psychoanalysis towards a sort of a sense of that analysis isn't for the, you know, digging up of the past, but to sort of a remusicalization in the present. And of course, it's a little pretentious to say we remusicalize. I mean, it's not an explicit idea that we're going to do music with the patient, but that there is a sense of how much how important it is what goes on in this domain of how we are mutually inducing each other, not just in terms of, you know, the mother-infant dyad, for example, where there's a kind of attunement between patient and therapist, but in terms of how we all belong to something much larger than the dyad and the Oedipal triad, and that music connects us to collective ways of being and our ability to replenish our ways of seeing, perceiving, moving in the world is so important. And that analysis, in a way, is a kind of venue where this happens. We haven't theorized it that way, but I think this is what we think happens in analysis.
Let me ask you about that. You make a distinction between what you call digging up the past, and I don't think anybody would sign on for any digging with a particular focus and intention. But it would seem to me that listening with a musical ear would inevitably allow us to hear both this present form that you're describing, the analytic dyad in real time, as well as how it lives as an expression of past music, synchronous or otherwise, in the person's life. So that when we are listening and when they are sharing and we do run into, we wouldn't call it interruptions, but dissynchronies, dissonances, things that don't seem to flow, that would incline us to listen to what the individual's past was with caregivers that were important to them at a young age. Is that not still staying true to the theme of your book?
Well, I would say that it's not that what you describe is not part of the situation as we understand it. But when you talk about the analyst listening, what shapes the analyst's ear? You know, in other words, listening not just because the analyst is analyzed or omniscient or an expert, although obviously there are elements of that are crucial, but in the analyst listening to the patient is authorized as therapeutic only insofar as the analyst's ear is tuned into some wider orchestra or what we call weave of how to be a human being. And without that, both participants in any analytic process would just be lost. So the extent to which, we're talking about music, obviously, in a broader sense than we usually use that word to refer to, you know, pieces of music, which are maybe highly mm-hmm. concentrated samples of what we're talking about. But we're talking about music in a much more general way. And if it's hard to think about it, if it's hard to define, I mean, it might be easier to imagine what it's like when it's not there, when there's an uncanny or very difficult experience, usually, but the experience is you just want it to be over, where there's no music playing. You know, it'd be like a movie without a soundtrack or a score or something. This is evoked in the kinds of in many of the papers about dissociated patients that Peter has written over the last several decades. So I don't think we're talking about replacing the bread and butter of analytic work with something radically different, but more just trying to understand what makes that work in the first place.
Okay. Peter, you're about to say something, or should we turn to Adam for his paragraph?
Well, but what you're raising, Harvey, is, I mean, I'm with Adam completely, that I think you're right that the past lives, you know, the past of the patient and the therapist and their individual way of carrying themselves in the tempo and rhythm of their own personal embodied lives are brought mm-hmm. into the sure. analytic setting and will sort of show up. You know, the question of whether analyst and patient can actually start being like in a jazz band together, you know, where you have to really listen to each other, but you can play off each other. This is a poor use of a metaphor, but that's what develops. But it is true. I mean, one idea that hasn't come up yet in our discussion, or one important thing, is that the fact that music is so important for our constitution, at least this is our understanding, that music is almost how we move in the world, you know, that our own bodies are played through by musical forms, you know, that the way we relate to our own way of being in the world is sort of mediated by music. This makes, you know, this is, I think Adam said earlier, powerful stuff. But it's not always very fitting to us. In other words, we hear a lot of music in our lives. We don't always choose what we hear. We don't choose our analyst's musicality. You know, we go and see somebody. We don't first check out what kind of musicality does our analyst have, right? We are bombarded by music. Music can impose upon us. It can make us feel within ourselves things in a way that doesn't feel right to us. So there's a lot of complexity here as we think about this matter of music being so central to us, where there's a way in which we have to find the music that works for us, but we don't create the music. It belongs to the realm of collective cultural life. So there's quite a lot of struggle, I think, over music. And in the analytic setting, there's a lot of struggle because for many patients, a lot of the work rests on whether there can be any shared sensory experience or not.
Adam, you got a paragraph?
Yes. So I'll just set up one reference in the paragraph to Stephen Sondheim and his use of the word ritual. This comes from a little video we found on YouTube that we'll post in the show notes if the listener is interested. We also discuss it in the book. And Sondheim is working with a rather nervous theater student trying to help him sing a song from Sondheim's magnum opus, Sweeney Todd. The song is called My Friends. And this poor guy is apparently not doing it right for the maestro. And I thought I've got the piano here. I thought I would just play the first chord of sure. the piece that Sondheim is trying to help this guy sing. And the issue is that he doesn't want the student to sing the song as if he's communicating something to the audience. He says, this is not communication. This is ritual. And what's happening in the music is there's just one chord that is just sort of undulating in what's known as a vamp. So I'm just going to play this chord. Have a moment of music in here to set the mood. So here's our paragraph. The question as to which kinds of psychical projects music may be recruited to manage, for better or worse, is often a question of electrical intensity, of how much energy must be screened out by what Freud called the stimulus barrier, the filtering and titration of stimuli that amounts to an alternation of sensory search and withdrawal, the periodicity of perception itself. But regardless of how well the perceptual apparatus regulates the influx of sensory input, the psychical impact of other people is always slipping through the gates. We are always letting in more than we bargained for. The well-regulated titration of electrical input is always sabotaged by the excesses of unconscious transmission. There is always more heat being produced than the system predicted. And the only source of relief from the electrocution of unconscious sexuality, transmitted unwittingly through the provision of help, from caregiver to cared for, is by harnessing the creative potential of sexuality, the capacity of the sexual drive to propel the body back into musical movement and transmute the seizure of trauma into conducted energy to ground the current. For those messages that are translatable, where there is good enough music, the energized elements can be translated and incorporated into one's ever-emerging musicality. Can fit into the personal score. We could call this eros or binding. The function of enchantment, of musical ritual, as Sondheim, echoing LaPlanche, puts it, is not only to remember the dismembered body, but also as a complicated, even perverse attempt to be remembered by or into the collective weave, to embed the otherwise merely humanoid body, Frankenstein's monster, into a recognizably human life. Embeddedness in this weave is the only position, the only neighborhood, through which to translate the electricity of becoming sexual into the life drive of being human.
It's hard to know what to say after that.
It's a lot of voltage. You know, we're picking up here in some ways on Freud's original abandoned project of trying to account for this in terms of electrical energy, whereby we become conductors as opposed to insulators of energy.
You know, on the one hand, I'm interested in what the two of you have to say about what we just listened to. And as I sit with it, and we'll reread it, I'm sort of inclined to let the listener sit with it as well. I think anything we would say now would diminish what we just heard. And perhaps that's a good place for us to close. I'm going to ask Adam a favor. Can you read that one more time? And that will be how we sign out. But before we do that, I want to thank the three of you. This has been a journey, certainly for me, in reading and studying your work, to getting to know the three of you and encountering you through this, and to really marvel at the thoughtfulness and nuance of your thinking. It's been a real privilege, a challenge at times. I mean, there are parts of the book that are challenging, and one should know that in going into this book. But if there is so much that will that you will be left with, that will, like, we're going to be left with this paragraph. So I want to thank you for that. And Adam, if you will do an encore.
What a dream come true. Yes, and I'll just say on behalf of the three of us, thank you so much, Harvey, for having us. And I can't imagine a more musical decision than what you just decided to do. So case in point.
Absolutely.
The question as to which kinds of psychical projects music may be recruited to manage, for better or worse, is often a question of electrical intensity, of how much energy must be screened out by what Freud called the stimulus barrier, the filtering and titration of stimuli that amounts to an alternation of sensory search and withdrawal, the periodicity of perception itself. But regardless of how well the perceptual apparatus regulates the influx of sensory input, the psychical impact of other people is always slipping through the gates. We are always letting in more than we bargained for. The well-regulated titration of electrical input is always sabotaged by the excesses of unconscious transmission. There's always more heat being produced than the system predicted. And the only source of relief from the electrocution of unconscious sexuality, transmitted unwittingly from caregiver to cared for, is by harnessing the creative potential of sexuality, the capacity of the sexual drive to propel the body back into musical movement and transmute the seizure of trauma into conducted energy to ground the current. For those messages that are translatable, where there is good enough music, the energized elements can be translated and incorporated into one's ever-emerging musicality, can fit into the personal score. We could call this eros or binding. The function of enchantment, of musical ritual, as Sondheim puts it, is not only to remember the dismembered body, but also as a complicated attempt to be remembered by or into the collective weave, to embed the otherwise merely humanoid body, Frankenstein's monster, into a recognizably human life. Embeddedness in this weave is the only position, the only neighborhood, through which to translate the electricity of becoming sexual into the life drive of being human.
Thank you all. Yes, bravo, indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Harvey.
Us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.